Hi, this is John Stone Street, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, which you can find online at breakpoint.org. The Colson Center is pleased to support listening in. Enjoy the program.
I'm Warren Smith, and today you'll be listening in on my conversation with one of the elder statesmen of Christian higher education in this country, Dr. David Dockery.
Yeah, we were in the dark. We lost power immediately, so it was hard to see, but the devastation was obvious everywhere, and students started coming out of their rooms. They were cut and bleeding. The flying glass had hurt many of them. Some were hurt very badly.
It's likely that Christian education in this country would look significantly different were it not for the life and work of David Dockery. He served as president of Trinity International University in the Chicago area and as president of Union University during a time when Union faced a significant crisis, which we'll talk about later in the program, and emerged from that crisis as one of the nation's leading Christian colleges. Dockery has also used his gifts to serve Christian education beyond the colleges he has led directly. He's consulted or served on the board of many important Christian institutions, including Christianity Today and the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. He's also been active in the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, where he served as chairman of the board, and the Evangelical Theological Society, which he served as its president. At a time when many people would be thinking about retirement, Dockery is 68 years old. He resigned his post at Trinity International University to lead a new group, the International Alliance of Christian Education, which is made up of Christian schools, colleges and universities, and seminaries from all over the world. We'll discuss that group in our conversation today. During this period of COVID, when travel has been restricted, David Dockery and I had this conversation via a bit of electronic magic. Dr. Dockery was in his home in the Chicago area, and I was in my home studio in Charlotte, North Carolina. David Dockery, welcome to the program. You know, you and I have known each other for a few years at least, and I tried to get you on the program whenever you were the president of the Evangelical Theological Society, I guess maybe a couple of years ago, but you were too busy being president at that time for us to find any time together.
I apologize for that, Warren, but I am grateful for the privilege to be with you today. I'm honored to have this conversation.
Well, as am I. In fact, I mentioned that not fishing for an apology or anything along those lines, but just really to make the point that, and I don't know how this description sits on you, but I'm going to say it anyway. You're sort of one of the elder statements of the evangelical movement. You were, as I said, president of the Evangelical Theological Society. You've been on the board of directors of the Coalition of Christian Colleges and Universities, the Consortium for Global Education. You've been on the board of Christianity Today. I mean, you've had a unique vantage point to look at Christian education and evangelicalism generally in this country, I would say.
I think that is true. I'm just, you know, when I reflect upon the pilgrimage that the Lord has allowed us to take, I'm overwhelmed by the opportunities, and it has given me a variety of vantage points to see the work of the church in this country and around the globe.
Well, and I want to talk about that and get some specific thoughts from you about that. But I want to begin our conversation, if we might, David Dockery, with your latest gig, if I might put it that way, the International Alliance for Christian Education. This is a new organization. You're leading this organization. Tell me about it and why you think it's necessary right now.
Well, we believe that it's a very timely opportunity to connect and bring together all aspects of Christian education. You know, for many years, Christian educators have functioned and known about one another, but we've not worked together very well. When I say that, I mean that those in the primary and secondary schools have worked in their lane, and those in the Bible college world have worked over in their sphere, and then the Christian colleges and universities have been in another place, and then there were the seminaries. What the International Alliance for Christian Education attempts to do is to create an alliance. That is the key word in our name, to create collaboration from early education to PhD programs, and to connect all of these educational entities so that we might hook arms, share resources, strengthen one another, particularly in a time when we're all facing financial, economic, cultural, demographic, and denominational issues. And we can learn from each other, and we'll be better together than we will be apart. So it's not just an alliance for Christian higher education, which is where my work has focused, but it actually has the entire network of the Association for Christian Schools International, ACSI, in which gives us hundreds of primary and secondary schools in this country and around the world. I don't want to overstate, you know, who we are, what we're trying to do, because we're only 7 months old. As you said, we're brand new. We started January the 1st of this year. But we don't believe there's ever been an attempt to bring this kind of alliance together. And people are quite excited about this, and they're meeting new people and learning from each other. And so it's a very encouraging initiative at this point.
Well, let me ask a hard question right here at the beginning, because you've been involved with the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities in the past. In fact, you were chairman of the board of that organization. There's been some controversy associated with that organization over the years. Some have been concerned that there's been a sort of a liberal shift in that organization. There have been, other challenges that different organizations, schools, colleges have faced. So let me just ask directly, is what you're doing at IACE a response to any deficiency there? Or is it truly what you say, an attempt to throw an umbrella over the entire Christian education world and get them to lock arms and work together?
It is primarily the latter. We are trying to do something quite different, and we're trying to do something different and distinctive from the CCCU. We appreciate the work of the CCCU. It is a more broad coalition theologically than IACE. IACE is intentionally confessional. To be a member, one has to affirm the transformational power of the gospel, the truthfulness of the Bible, the Nicene Creed, and the Lausanne Covenant, and to commit ourselves to traditional understandings of Christian ethics. And that has been an important way to define this group. And it has been the center around which all of these other groups have coalesced. And so, in that sense, we are broader in terms of how we connect all these entities than any other Christian education group out there. But in some ways, we're more narrow than the other groups because of our confessional commitments.
Gotcha. I want to ask you about some of the challenges that you briefly mentioned that Christian education is facing right now, and I would say maybe Christian higher education in particular, but I'm not sure that that's true exactly. Maybe all Christian education is facing this, but one of them is a demographic challenge that we're just to say it plainly, we're making less babies than we used to, and there's been a bit of a demographic bubble that has gone through Christian schools and colleges over the last 20 or 30 years that is getting smaller and smaller. We're seeing Christian colleges shut down. We're seeing others that have some pretty serious financial difficulties. First of all, am I accurately assessing that situation? Is that what you're seeing too? And how will an organization like the International Alliance for Christian Education help institutions address this challenge?
Well, I think you have read the situation quite well. This is my 36th year in the work of Christian higher education. I started out as a faculty member in 1984, became an administrator in the early 90s, was named president at Union University in 1995, and then president of Trinity Evangelical Divinity School in 2014, and now in this work. And so this is 36 years. So I've seen this work from various perspectives. I've never seen a time in which multiple challenges are coming together all at once. And the COVID-19 issues have only accelerated those and amplified them for many people. But particularly the demographic issue that you mentioned is very real. From 1995 to 2007, Christian higher education was the fastest growing sector of all aspects of higher education. So think about that for a minute. There are 5,000 accredited institutions across the United States, and you can break them down into community colleges, research universities, private schools, public schools, you know, for-profit entities. But the Christian piece in there, which includes Protestant and Roman Catholic schools, so broadly Christian, was the fastest growing sector in higher education from 1995 to 2007. When the economic issues hit in 2008 and 9, that came to a screeching halt. There was a years of plateau, and then for the last 5 or 6 years, we've been in a measurable decline, and that decline will probably continue for two reasons. One, because the pool of students is smaller, as you mentioned, the demographics are not good, and particularly as you get out to 2025 or 2026, they begin to fall off the table almost, at least in terms of projections. But secondly, mm-hmm. a very real issue is the rise of the nuns, the N-O-N-E-S, the religiously unaffiliated families across the United States. So approximately a third of Americans now would identify loosely as, you know, religiously unaffiliated, as a nun. What does that mean? They probably have some kind of spirituality. They may have some kind of religious heritage. But that is a third of the student population that is not going to be looking at a school that proclaims itself as a Christ-centered institution first and foremost. And so you've got a double whammy at work here. And yeah. The schools are, for the most part, tuition-driven. I mean, you can name the schools that have endowment, a significant endowment, on one hand and have a couple of fingers left over. It's very small. So every school is tuition-driven. And so for years, we were having to raise tuition just to be able to create new revenue streams and new resources. But we hit a price point about the time of the economic crisis. And so we've been leveled off there for about a decade. And so there's no place really for schools to turn for new revenue. So you have flat tuition, declining demographics, and then the rise of the religiously unaffiliated. And it has created economic strain of severe proportions for many institutions, some who, frankly, will have a difficult time making it to 2025.
Right. Now, that in addition to that demographic challenge that you've been talking about, Dr. Dockery, for the last few minutes, there's also technology. And now, technology is not a new thing. I mean, we've been dealing with technology since the printing press, but within the last 20 or 25 years, I would say that technology has been more of a driver in education, perhaps, than it has been in the, say, the 20 years before that. The internet and distance learning, that sort of thing. I'm wondering what you think about how the COVID crisis is going to impact the adoption of technology, especially for distance learning applications. A lot of us are a whole lot more comfortable with Zoom calls than we have been in the past. And I'm just wondering, will that be a a challenge for Christian education, or will it be an opportunity for Christian education?
The answer is yes to both questions. It is a problem and a challenge for us because we maintain that a key part of what we do is not just deliver a different kind of information, but we create a sense of community in which there is interaction and interrelationships among people to help foster a context for not just advancement in information, but to move toward genuine transformation in people's lives.
I've heard that Christians are an incarnational people, and that while we can use technology for certain things, that you really can't incarnate the incarnation without being with people.
That's right. There's something about Mark chapter 3, verse 14 that remains haunting for me. Jesus called the disciples, and we usually read the passage, we read it so quickly. Jesus called the disciples and then he sent them out to preach. But there's a little phrase in there that's right in the middle of the verse. Jesus called the disciples to be with him. Then he sent them out to preach. Mm. And that with him component is, I think, a key to a distinctive Christian education. So how we create the context for formation in an online setting is a genuine challenge. I'm convinced we can deliver the information just as well online as you can in a classroom. What I think remains a challenge, an opportunity for us, is to find ways to address taking the next steps toward formation and transformation.
You're listening in today on my conversation with Dr. David Dockery. Dockery has written more than 35 books, many of them on Baptist history and theology, as well as Christian education. I'm Warren Smith, and we'll have more with David Dockery after this short message.
Hi, I'm John Stone Street, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. You can help us carry on the legacy of Chuck Colson by becoming a Colson Fellow. To find out more about this intensive one-year deep dive program into Christian Worldview, go to breakpoint.org and click on Colson Fellows at the top of the page.
Welcome back. I'm Warren Smith, and today you're listening in on my interview with Dr. David Dockery. One of the defining moments of David Dockery's life and career took place in February of 2008, when a rare winter tornado struck the campus of Union University in Jackson, Tennessee, while Dockery was president. The story made international news in part because of the severity and rarity of a February tornado, the fact that it almost completely leveled the campus, and, most remarkably, the fact that no one died in the disaster. The tornado also gave Dockery and his leadership team a clean slate to rebuild Union University for the 21st century. David Dockery, I'd like to shift gears a little bit in our conversation and talk to you about a particular episode in your life that I know you've got a unique perspective on it, and that is something that happened when you were the president of Union University. February 5th, 2008, at about 7 in the evening, Union University was struck by a very powerful tornado, 160 to 200 miles an hour. I think it was an EF4 tornado.
Right. More than 200 mile per hour winds, right?
And it more or less leveled the college. I paid attention to that because I was born in Memphis. My family is all around Jackson and Martin and Bradford, Tennessee, all that kind of, you know, west, mm-hmm. northwest Tennessee area. So I paid, and I had a niece that ultimately graduated from Union as well. So I was paying attention to it. It's an amazing story. Would you sort of pick it up from there?
February the 5th, 2008, 7:02 p.m. to be exact. We know that because all the clocks stopped. This EF4 tornado came right through the middle of the Union campus. I was in my office along with two other deans. We were hunkered down praying that the Lord would spare us. I had a window that faced east in my office. The tornado came from the west. It came from Memphis directly down I-40 and toward the Union campus, which sits 1 mile north of Interstate 40 in Jackson. We could see this orange blur and this huge sound, you know, go over our heads. And I turned to my two colleagues and said, "Perhaps we've been spared." At the same time, my phone rang and said, "Come to the Residence Life area. We've been hit." And so we were not spared. Just the building that I was in, the administration building, happened to be spared, but over 60% of the campus was hit. Academic buildings, the entire student life area was leveled, almost all the dorms. We had about 1,200 students, is our best guess, on campus that night. Now, our student population is far larger than that, but at that particular time, that's how many students were there right after dinner.
Doctor, could I pause you right there for a moment, Dr. Dockery? Because I mean, I just can't imagine what must have been going through your head at 7:02. I mean, you're there, you're hunkered down, you're praying, but you think maybe things are okay. But when you walk outside, knowing that there are over 1,000 kids on campus, and you saw, I'm assuming you immediately saw the devastation, is that correct?
Yeah, we were in the dark. We lost power immediately, so it was hard to see, but the devastation was obvious everywhere. And students started coming out of their rooms. They were cut and bleeding. The flying glass had hurt many of them. Some were hurt very badly. We took over 60 students to the hospital that night, 9 that were injured severely and had long-term hospital stays. But about the time that I got to the Residence Life area, which was 7:05, 7:06, we started hearing these words, "Come over here, we're trapped." And we had a dozen students that were trapped under fallen walls. That it took us 5 hours to dig them out of those walls. By the grace of God, they all survived. They were all hurt, but no one died. And the emergency management system, when they arrived, told me that we'd never said this at that particular moment, but we've said it since in several contexts. They brought at least 100 body bags with them, knowing that the devastation on campus, they knew there had to be many deaths. It was not until the dogs finished, you know, sniffing and going around the campus at 3 a.m. the next morning that we were assured that no one had died. And we were just rejoicing, giving thanks to God. But the campus was devastated. $45 million worth of damage in 45 seconds as that tornado zipped through the campus. And we had to almost start afresh. Some wondered whether Union University was done. I mean, we had board members who said, "I don't know how we recover from this." And we began working. We called a special board meeting immediately, began planning, trusting the Lord to allow us to restart the spring semester, which we did 2 weeks later in what we called the Union Diaspora. Because students were, about 1,000 students were living in homes across the Jackson community. The broadcast and journalism school were meeting at the ABC affiliate. The education school was meeting at a Christian education building. The business school moved to the Black & Decker conference rooms. I mean, we were all over the city. And the music department moved to a large mega church that had a big music facility. And it was somehow, by the grace of God, we were able to start the semester 2 weeks later. We actually started at 7:02 p.m. 2 weeks later by gathering in the chapel to pray and give thanks to God for sparing our campus and giving us a new start. 9 months later, we had at least rebuilt most of the dorms so the students could come back. We had 5 construction companies that usually competed with each other for projects on the Union campus that came to me and said, "We've decided we're going to work together to help you rebuild the campus. I started crying. It was overwhelming to me to hear that. And they worked together as teams, and therefore we had every possible resource available to us to try to rebuild the campus. And we were able to restart the fall semester, and then eventually 2 years later, exactly on February the 5th, 2010, the Student Life Building was completed and the Events Center was completed, and we had all the campus was restored. God was so good. We had an $18 million gap between what the insurance company covered in terms of replacement cost and what it was going to cost us to rebuild the facilities, particularly to rebuild the dorms stronger. We wanted to send a signal to the parents that the dorms were going to be as strong as possible. And so we were able to do that. These construction companies came together to help us rebuild it. And by the grace of God, it all came together. It's a story of God's providence. There's no way to describe what happened apart from God doing a special work and touching Union University. He gave us a sense of hope that carried us through. From day one, we asked everybody that we knew to pray that God would bring renewal out of rubble. And he did that. And it's actually the most traumatic and most significant natural disaster to ever hit an American university campus, even bigger than the hurricanes that hit New Orleans in 2005.
That's amazing.
So it's God did something that we could not do, and we just marvel still.
Well, it's amazing because, you know, Union University founded in the early 1800s, 1823. I don't think people realize just how old that school is, especially for so far west. I mean, 1823 in West Tennessee was a frontier probably at that time. And, you know, you had a lot of old buildings there. I mean, you were a good school, becoming a great school. But in some ways, this was you talk about God's providence. This was a truly remarkable providence, wasn't it? Because you were probably able to modernize the campus in ways that you might not even have been able to otherwise.
We were in the midst of a major campus building plan that had started in 1997. It was a 25-year plan to completely rebuild the campus. So we were about a decade into that model. So one of the things that helped us is that we had some plans in place of what we, you know, knew that we wanted to do. We were able to modify those plans quickly, you know, adapt them to the immediate need. And so we already had architects who had been working with us on that.
Right.
The city and county came to us and said, we will fast track anything you need as far as, you know, approvals to get moving, and they did. And because we had this relationship with the architect, and because these construction companies came together to help us and the support from the city and the county, those were the human instruments that God used to guide the process, as well as some wonderful donors, from some of our best donors who gave seven-figure gifts to a six-year-old who gave us the money from her birthday party to help us rebuild the campus. That in some ways was the biggest gift of all.
You're listening in today on my conversation with the former president of Union University, Dr. David Dockery. During his tenure there, the college more than doubled in size to nearly 5,000 students. And he also, as you just heard, completely rebuilt the college following a devastating 2008 tornado. I'm Warren Smith, and we'll have a few final words with Dr. David Dockery after this short message.
Hi, I'm John Stone Street, the president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, and I'm delighted that the Colson Center is now the lead sponsor for Listening In. The Colson Center exists to inform, equip, and unite believers. And that's why we're delighted to unite with World to bring this informative program to you, a program designed to better equip you for the work of the gospel. To learn more about the Colson Center and our Breakpoint radio and podcast ministries, please visit us at breakpoint.org. That's breakpoint.org.
You're listening in today on my interview with Dr. David Dockery. Let's get right back to that conversation. Well, I guess I want to go in a couple of different directions here, but I want to start with this, with the idea of mentorship and leadership. I think one of the things that you are known for is that I don't know if any of our listeners are sports fans, but sometimes they talk about the coaching tree of a coach, where a coach of an NFL team might have an assistant coach that goes on to be a head coach somewhere else, or maybe an offensive coordinator that goes on to be an offensive coordinator somewhere else, and then he has other folks in his downline, you might say. You've got that sort of reputation within Christian higher ed. Mm-hmm. Where a lot of the folks that worked for you early in their career have gone on to positions of leadership as their career has matured. Has that been an intentional thing? Has this idea of being a mentor to younger faculty and faculty members and administrators been something that you've strived for, or has that just been something that in God's providence happened in your life?
Well, it is obviously something in God's providence that he has done, and I give him the credit for it. But it was an idea that we had all along, that we would try to develop leaders around us who could go and replicate what we were doing, or at least take the ideas and adapt them to different contexts. And so today there are a double handful of college and seminary presidents with whom I've had the privilege of being associated, who are going on and doing the work, most of them doing it far better than I ever was able to do. They're good at what they do, and they're all over the country and even in one international context.
Well, given that, what are some of the things that, like, if I were going to ask you, okay, I want to be David Dockery when I grow up. I want to be not only a leader in my own right, but someone who nurtures other leaders. What are some of the things that you would recommend that I do?
To think deeply, to drink deeply from the well of the Christian tradition. To recognize that what we're trying to do is not new, but it has been a part of Christianity throughout its history. Everywhere Christianity has been planted, soon there have been educational entities and schools planted and teaching people basic things so that they could read the Bible well was, one of the reasons for doing this. It's as early as what happens with Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8. How can I understand these things unless someone explains it to me? And so we need explainers, and we need people to understand that since the time of the second century, this has taken place. And so there were informal schools that developed. We know about Alexandria and Antioch, but there were other smaller entities. And then it was a key part of the Reformation. Luther was a professor, and then Melanchthon helped spread the Luther vision to start 8 other universities across Germany. And so we try to teach people this history of Christian education. So drink deeply of that tradition. 2, to understand the need for a distinctive mission, that piety alone will not sustain distinctive Christian education. It has to be a Christian worldview that shapes and informs what we're doing, that can be applied to every area of life and to every discipline that is studied. 3rdly, to create contexts that help people learn to maximize their strengths. We're all different. God has gifted us differently, and so we don't all lead or do the things the same way, but we do our best when we maximize our strengths and then surround ourselves with others who can complement those things. And then fourthly, to be very open-handed, very open-hearted, not think of this as I, but we, not me, but us, you know, so that we're all in this together. And God has been so good to us to give us those privileges.
Well, yeah, Gene Fant, in fact, has been on the program before, this podcast, and several other. Dub Oliver, who is one of your proteges as well, succeeded you as president at Union University, also has been on the show. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, that I know of your influence in that arena. Dr. Dockery, I would like to pivot one last time in our conversation and maybe bring us to a close here, because since I've got you, I can't resist sort of tapping into this unique perspective that you've had at 35 plus years in a variety of evangelical institutions, and just ask this: how we doing? How is evangelicalism doing as a movement? You talked about the rise of the nuns a little while ago, you know, that is not only having an impact on Christian education. You've got, you know, parents who have abandoned their faith who now have no interest in raising their children in the faith. But it also has some implications for our country as well, obviously. Does that concern you? Do you think that that's the bottom of a trough and that we're about to experience, you know, some sort of a rise from that trough? Or what do you see right now?
Well, let me answer it in two or three different ways. One, I've had the privilege of learning from some of those who helped to shape American evangelicalism in the 20th century. I was blessed to have mentors like Carl F. H. Henry and Chuck Colson and some people who really invested their lives in mine. And so I've known those people and seen the way they influenced and you know, saw their dreams for the evangelical world. And evangelicalism is always, at its best, a renewal movement. And right now, it seems to me that evangelicalism needs renewing. We're not in a very good place, I'm afraid. Our churches are not as strong as they could be. We've already talked about our institutions, and some of them are in difficult places. The theological and cultural issues, we're being pulled in multiple directions. I'm afraid that many of us have inverted the Great Commandment, so that the horizontal and social issues are more primary than the vertical and theological issues. And I think that we have to keep the Great Commandment priorities right, to love God first and then love our neighbor as ourselves. And I think when we get those things out of order, it always leads to confusion. And I think we're at one of those moments. So many of us have written about that and tried to address it, but it's we of course need the balance. You have to have both. Carl Henry wrote The Uneasy Conscience of American Fundamentalism because we did not have a balance, you know, at that time. That's been 70 years ago. So we need both, but we also need to keep them rightly prioritized. The exciting thing that what encourages me is to not necessarily look at American evangelicalism, to look at global evangelicalism. You know, I've had the privilege to travel to Africa, to Asia, to Australia, you know, across the global South. What God is doing across the global South is amazing. Churches that are developing, schools that are developing. There are schools like Uganda Christian University with 10,000 students, Torch Trinity University in South Korea, you know, many others that I could name that are as strong or stronger than almost any Christian college in this country. And we need to give thanks for that and celebrate it. And so I think when we think globally, in terms of global evangelicalism, there's much to celebrate. And we need to give thanks to God for that. And perhaps that's where we turn our attention now. But I don't want us to give up on North American evangelicalism, which frankly is struggling and needs a compass readjustment. And I pray to God that he might take what has been a renewal movement for a larger Christianity and bring renewal at this time. You know, we were in a very difficult place in the late 1960s. And out of that, as there were theological drifts and cultural drifts, the Jesus movement came along, and there was a new kind of youth movement that brought a renewal. You know, so I'm praying that that might repeat, that we could see another Jesus movement across. Those didn't come out of the Christian colleges. Unfortunately, they came out of secular campuses. And I was at the University of Alabama at the time when that happened in the early 1970s. And I pray that on secular public campuses, you know, God might do a work that could be good for the next 20, 30, or 40 years in this country. We'll just have to trust Him to do that. But so I answer your question in two ways. Global evangelicalism, I'm very hopeful and wave the banner high. North American evangelicalism, let us pray that God would bring renewal and be merciful and give us one more opportunity.
That brings to a close my conversation with Dr. David Dockery. Several of David Dockery's proteges have been guests on Listening in the past. They include Dub Oliver, who is now the president of Union University, Gene Fant, the president of North Greenville University, and Greg Thornberry, who was at Union and then became president of the King's College. You can find those interviews and interviews with other college presidents that we've done in the past by going to the World News Group website, WNG.org, and using the search engine to find them. In fact, the Listening In archives is a treasure trove of more than 400 interviews with politicians, artists, musicians, filmmakers, and other culture makers. If you're new to the program, I'd like to encourage you to explore our back catalog. And you can do that, again, at the World News Group website. That's WNG.org/listeningin, or, as I mentioned just a moment ago, use the search engine at the top of the page. Listening In comes to you from World News Group, and this program is just one of the many benefits of World membership. To find out more about becoming a member of World, go to getworldnow.com. The producer for today's program is Johnny Franklin, and he gets technical support from Carl Peets and Kristen Flavin. Our executive producer is Nick Eicher. I'm your host, Warren Smith, and you've been Listening In.